Okay, so if you haven't got a Bible, now's the time to grab yourself one. We're in Luke chapter 14. If you do need a Bible and you don't know where to get one, just raise your hand where you are and we'll make sure we get one for you. That would be our pleasure. So we're in Luke chapter 14. And last time, for those of you who are here, we saw that Jesus is teaching, and the main message of chapter 14 is that Jesus wants my heart, not just my actions. Jesus wants my heart, not just my actions. And we saw how in this chapter, if we break down this chapter, we can break it down into five things that Jesus is warning us against, but really saying, look, here's five ways, here's five false ways of loving God. Five false ways of loving God that show us the condition of our heart. So it's not just five ways of falsehood that we kind of lean to in terms of action, but they're almost indicators of where our hearts are at. We can use these things to judge our own hearts. And so look at the first one, false holiness, verses 1 to 6, false holiness. Look, and he's done this before, right? He did this in chapter 12. He said, the direction of your money demonstrates the direction of your heart. That's what he says in chapter 12. The flow of your money is the flow of your heart. Whichever direction your money is flowing in, that's the direction of your heart. And so he's saying the same thing here. Look, verses 1 to 6, false holiness. What do you do with the Sabbath? What do you do with the Sabbath? Verses 7 to 11, false popularity. How do you talk about yourself? How do you talk about others? Are you prone to talk well of yourself and criticize others? Verses 12 to 14, false hospitality. Who do you invite into your friendship group? How do you open up your home? Do you invite open up your home? If you don't, there's a problem not with your hospitality, Jesus says, there's a problem with your heart. Simple. These are indicators of where our hearts are at. Verses 15 to 24, false priorities. Are you bound up with the things of this world? Are you so tied down that if God said move, you would not be able to move? Then finally, the final measure of where you, whether your heart is for God or is not for God, is in this last section that we come to this morning. And I've given this title, the false expectation. False expectation. So we have a false holiness, a false popularity, false hospitality, false priorities, and now false expectation. And Jesus in these few verses is going to ruthlessly and almost violently go after our hearts. And again, this is all about judging our hearts, finding out where our hearts are at, because Jesus wants our hearts more than he wants our actions. And so verse 25, let's pick it up. Now great crowds accompanied him. So he's just leaving the feast where he'd been invited to. He'd been invited to dine at the ruler of the Pharisees' house. And pretty much all of chapter 14 has been located in this man's house. And so now he leaves, and there's crowds there waiting for Jesus as he leaves the house. And they start walking with him. That's the tents there. They accompanied him. So he's going and the crowds are going. And there's a huge sense of expectancy in the air. What is Jesus going to do next? Large crowds had gathered. But Jesus, you know, as we read in the other Gospels, and certainly in Luke as well, Jesus was never really impressed with crowds. What he has to say to them, actually, isn't so much as trying to keep the crowds or gain the crowds. He's actually trying to thin the crowds out. He's trying to make the crowd into less of a crowd. And what he has to say actually isn't the same as what you might expect in, you know, today's church growth circles. You know, how to win people and influence people, that you won't find it in this section. Because he turned to them. And there is a sense in the Greek that he turned, you know, fairly quickly and violently, and he had something to say to them. He turned to them and he said, verse 26, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. So, you know, today, if you just think about our current kind of Christian climate, Today, almost everything is done in order to gain a crowd, right? We'll go to great lengths to gain a crowd. And sometimes, you know, you have to gain a crowd to give them the gospel, right? But, you know, even to the extent where I've read and I know of some churches offering incentives to join up. One church I was reading about, it has its own gym. Nothing wrong with that. You know, if you're in a community that doesn't have that and you're trying to get people in, there's nothing wrong with that. But to ask them to say, well, if you join the church, you get 50% off of our gym. Now that's pushing it. Churches that offer nurseries, midweek nurseries, fantastic, brilliant service. Christian education to the community, excellent. But if you join our church, we'll give you 75% off nursery fees this week. Incentives to just gain a big crowd. But you know, the problem is once the crowd has been gathered, almost everything then is done to keep the crowd. And I've said, you know, countless times, if you attract people that way, you've got to keep people that way. And we find then almost everything is done in order to keep the crowd. It's one thing to get the crowd, but another entirely to keep the crowd. And so there's no sermons, but instead we have chat shows. You know, we have sofas and we talk about people rather than about Jesus. There's no sermons. There's no Bible. Let's talk about ways to stay healthy and stay fit or to raise children. No worship. Let's have entertainment instead so they can keep the crowd. But look at what Jesus is doing. And he's apparently more interested in thinning out the crowd than he is keeping the crowd. Because at one point previously, he said, what I'm about to tell you, I know this is going to be difficult, and many of you, you're going to leave. Now, in modern days, we would go, don't say it then. Don't say it. Just keep them coming. Jesus says, no. It's not about keeping the crowd. It's telling the truth. And if people then leave, Seemingly, Jesus knows that there's people in the crowd who are not in the least bit interested in spiritual things. Not in the least bit interested. He knew that some were only there for the miracles. Some were there maybe for the signs. Maybe they were there for the food. Maybe they'd heard of the feeding of the 5,000. They're thinking, I'm going to get me some of that. And maybe some he knew that some were only there because they hoped that, you know, he was going to be a revolutionary and he was going to bring down the Romans and they wanted to be there to see that. He knew that some were only there because others were there. They didn't know why they were there, but they were there. And it's not that Jesus is uninterested. We shouldn't get that from the text. It's not that Jesus is uninterested in crowds. He's not uninterested in how many people follow him, but he is interested that people follow him. And they follow him rightly. What that means is that Jesus is saying, look, this thing that we call Christianity is not a spectator sport. You don't buy your ticket and sit on your seat and watch. That's what that means. And so Jesus is now going to set about correcting their expectations for whatever reason they've come from for. Whatever reason, and you might put it into our context, whatever reason today you've come out to church, you're well done for coming. But look, there are some corrections that need made to our own hearts, don't they, for the reasons that we come. Now, I want to suggest to you that verse 26 is our key verse. Verse 26 is what I might call our bracket verse. It's the main verse. And verses 27 to 33 that come after it are really just an explanation or a commentary or a little mini sermon on verse 26. Verse 26 is the most important verse. And as such, I'm going to spend most of my time talking about verse 26. Because I think the rest of the verses really are just, again, just an explanation of this verse. And so look what he says again. He says, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Now, firstly, just think about how clear that verse is. It's not confusing, is it? None of us are leaving this place going, I wonder what Jesus meant. You know, he doesn't mix his words. He's saying exactly what he means. It takes no explanation whatsoever. And yet the difficulty we have with it is because it is an incredibly difficult saying. And you know, what I don't want to do this morning is I don't want to soften the message. I mean, if you've come out this morning to hear a nice little sermon, make you feel good, unfortunately, you're not. It's not in that text, not in the text. And so I don't want to soften the message. It is, and you might want to write this down, this is a statement of hate. It's a statement of hate that Jesus is making. And it's expansive. He says, whoever, or anyone, if anyone, I mean, how broad is that, right? If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father. Well, some of you might be like, well, that's not so hard. Well, who else does it include? And mother. Okay, well, that might be fewer people. Who else? And wife. Or who else? And children. Anyone else? Yeah, brothers and sisters, aunts and uncles. I mean, that's the idea. It's just expansive. The list could go on and on to the point where he goes, yeah, and even in your own life. So don't be coming back and going, well, I hate my father anyway, so it's not much of a loss, really. Every time he grounds me, that's it. I'm never going to talk to him again. Yeah, but what about your own life? So it's expansive. It's going out. And so look, I don't want to go light on the implications of what Jesus is saying. And sometimes, you know, we're tempted to come to these passages and kind of minimize these hard sayings of Jesus, so they don't really say what we think they say, or at least we hope they don't say what they think what we think it says. Because we're hoping that it doesn't say, I've got to hate my father and my mother and my wife and my brothers and sisters and so on, and hate myself. We're hoping it doesn't say that. But you know, Jesus here has some alarming implications for us this morning. And he's going to touch on a nerve that none of us are going to like. None of us. I went to the dentist once, and I just had some work. It wasn't major work. Any dental work for me is enough work. Amen? Right? So I'm there in the chair, and I'm all, you know, I've got the goggles on, and I've got this cloth over half my face, and ready to go. You know, the dental technician is there. He's there peering over me, and he says, would you like pain relief? And I'm like, I'm a man. You know? I'm kind of like, I think of myself as being fairly, not hard, but I can take a little bit of pain. So I'm like, nah, I'm all right. Within 3 seconds, I had regretted that decision. Within 10 seconds, I was ready to punch him in the face. It was the longest 10 minutes in that chair that I have ever face. Why? No one likes nerves playing with. And how much more the nerves of our heart that really go deep, deep down. We can handle a little bit of a little bit of dental pain, but heart pain, it's much more problematic. And so the truth is that we can really put up with a lot of things, can't we? In terms of big things, we can put up a lot of things. I mean, you can take away stuff. I mean, you can burn my house down. You can take away my stuff. But a moment that you bring Laurie or one of my daughters into the equation, things are going to get difficult, right? Things are going to go hard. You're hitting on a nerve. And I mean, I get this. I never used to get it. I never thought that this was a problem. Heart pain. In terms of, you know, hitting on a nerve, children, daughters. Never thought it was a problem. For me, personally, just for me. until a guy shows up at a house. And looking for one of my daughters. And we had a short, one-sided conversation. And we never saw him again. And but it's, to this day, I remember feeling something happened in my heart. What was that? What was that? And then I thought I'd come to terms with it and dealt with it until the next time. And the next time. Until I found myself not answering the door, but peering out the window with my ice hockey mask on. Or introducing, or opening the door and introducing Laurie as my alibi rather than my wife. And then eventually another guy shows up and tells me, and this is several years later, that he'd like to take one of my daughters away from me. And he wants her to be his wife. And although I was a lot more gracious than I was several years prior to that, I got to hear his heart for her and we got to pray for them together. My heart was still in conflict. There was a nerve. And my heart is still in conflict. And it dawned on me that and this is a terrible term. Where do we get this term from? I'm just going to go angry for a second. Where do we get this term? Giving her away. I don't even understand that. I mean, I could understand it if I had some Scottish blood in me. Like, apologies. Like, at least I'd want something back. People keep asking me, you know, it's funny because, you know, she's getting married on Friday. People keep asking me about how difficult it is to walk down the aisle. Do you have any understanding how easy it is to walk? We do it every single day. No one bats an eyelid. And then you say, well, what about the speech? And the speech is worrying me. But that is nothing compared to how difficult it is in giving your daughter away. Does that make sense? You see, the speech thing, you can just go, thanks very much for coming, and good night. If worst comes to the worst, that is what I'm going to do. I'll tell you how it goes next week. If worst comes to the worst, we can crawl down the aisle. But giving someone away, giving your daughter away, at least for me, it speaks of conflict. It speaks of, I've been wrestling with this. I've been wrestling with this over several months. And all it was demonstrating was one thing. My heart is in conflict. My heart is in conflict. And so Jesus is speaking into that conflict. So for you guys who've got children, and for you guys who haven't got children but one day may have children, this is important. And even, you know, Jesus takes it out of, well, just having children, but what about your own life? Because everybody's got their own life. And so he's saying, look, he's going to speak into that conflict, the conflict of your heart, no matter what that conflict is about, whether it's children, whether it's about father, whether it's about mother, whether it's about wife, whether it's about brother, whether it's about sister, whether it's about your own life, there's a conflict of the heart that's going on, Jesus says. And look, what he's going to say in this verse 26, he's going to say three things, three statements. And then we're going to pause on each statement and we're going to ask, okay, what is this statement saying? What is this questioning? So look, to give you an example, firstly, he says, if anyone comes to me, and again, that invitation is broad. Anyone. It applies to anyone who would come after Christ, who would want to follow Christ. Anyone. But circle the word me. Because again, it's in contrast to the story that Jesus gave previously in this chapter about guests coming to a wedding feast. That's the contrast. And so Jesus is saying, look, he's not saying if anyone comes to a feast or if anybody comes after me. He's saying if anybody comes after me, me as being distinctly different from anyone else. If anyone comes after me, well, okay, so who are you? It's a great question to ask. Who are you? Who is the me? Who is the me? Because in Jesus' day, as he's speaking to this crowd, discipleship was all about following a rabbi. It was all about learning what the rabbi was teaching. It was all about reciting what the rabbi had taught. And from a very early age in childhood, you would go and sit under a rabbi's teaching, under different schools, numerous different schools in Israel, and then you would follow him in his ways and actions. But listen, we need to understand we're not coming just to another rabbi. We're not coming just to another teacher. Listen to how Paul describes Jesus in Colossians chapter 1. He says, he, that is Jesus, is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him and for him. And he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in everything he might be preeminent. For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross. That's who we are coming to. So when he says, anyone who comes to me, when you read this statement of hate that comes after this, make sure you understand that it's just not anyone who's saying it. When we're coming, when we follow Jesus, we're coming to the creator and sustainer of the universe. And the creator and sustainer of the universe is looking for preeminence in our lives, not just prominence in our lives. Do you get the difference? He doesn't want to be prominent. He doesn't care about being prominent. He cares about being preeminent. You might say, well, I don't understand the difference. Well, let me give you a quick illustration. If you were to go out and you were to, husbands, if you were to buy your wife flowers and you says, honey, here's some flowers for you. You're one of the most important people in my life. It's not going to go well for you. You will pay for that in more than flowers. This is kind of Jesus's point. He is not just important. He is everything. So when you come to me, he says, you've got to realize who you're coming to. Being a disciple is not part of how you live your life. It is your life. It's not about learning facts, but it's about yielding a life to the author of life. He says, you need to know who you're coming to. You're coming to the Lord and Master, creator and sustainer of the universe. I'm the one who is coming for your sin. I'm the one who will rise on the third day. You're not coming to a garden variety rabbi, you're coming to the second member of the Trinity who has existed from eternity past to eternity future, who never had a beginning and will never have an end. If anyone comes after me, he says. Does that help put it in context? So look at a second statement. And this is the hate statement. If anyone comes to me and does not hate. This is how we come to the Lord. We don't come to the Lord any other way. He doesn't say, if anyone comes to me, well, he's got to like me. He's got to like my teachings. He's got to agree with my teachings. He doesn't say that. He says, if anyone comes to me and does not hate, what Jesus is doing actually now is challenging our greatest loyalties. He's challenging our greatest loyalties. Our greatest loyalties, and then laid out in the text we've already read, does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters. Yes, even his own life. No exceptions. He puts it all on the table. And of course, look, it's not literal hate. We're instructed to love our families, aren't we? Right? We're instructed to do that. So please don't leave this place and say, well, Simon says I've got to hate you. You know, brothers, don't be quoting me. Right? Back of the car, sisters, don't be going, well, me, Simon said I've got to hate you. No, that's not what I'm saying. Love your brothers, love your sisters, love your husband, love your wife. Do that. Do it well. It's not literal hate. It's actually the Greek word for hate, where we get our English word misery from. Now, please, again, don't be quoting me on that and saying, well, Simon said I've got to be a misery to you. This is not dislike. It's a much stronger word. And we've got to get our heads around it. Actually, Jesus used this word. He didn't say whoever dislikes. He said, no, whoever hates. We need to see that it implies really two things. It implies not only rejection, but also implies affirmation. And it may be two good things to note down. It implies rejection, absolutely, but it also applies affirmation. We commonly associate hate with rejection. And that is certainly here in the text. Rejection. You see, in the Jewish model, in the Jewish mind, in Jewish culture of that day, love was not solely an emotion. Like, it, you know, we kind of say it is today. You know, love is primarily, we think of love primarily as an emotion, don't we? But certainly in Jewish and Hebrew culture, love was not solely an emotion. Love represented attachment, quite literally. Attachment. It's a good word to think of it. You know, when families grew up, when your children grew up, as they grew, rather than what we do now is we kick them out of the home and we say, well, you know, go and find a flat and go and stand on your own 2 feet and go and get your house and go and find a husband or a wife, go and, you know, children and bigger house. In Jewish culture, they didn't do that. In Jewish culture, they saw love as an attachment, literally. So as the children grew up, most homes had multiple families living in them, sons and daughters and of parents and families who, over time, they would extend their home so that they all could live in one house. As the family grew, so did the house. Attachment, literally. And the idea is that who you love, you are attached to. Who you love, you're attached to. But listen, by inference, that means those that you hate, you are detached from. Those that you hate, you're detached from. And again, that's primarily not an emotional detachment. To love means to be attached to, and to hate means to be detached from. Now, if you go back in Proverbs and Psalms and now read all of those hate passages in that light, you kind of get an understanding of where Solomon and the psalmist is talking about in terms of sin and hating sin, being detached from sin. And so embedded in the idea of discipleship is this idea of attachment. It's this idea of rejecting that which we hate. Now here's the question. What kind of intense love would make the love I have for my family appear to be detachment? What kind of attachment would I have, would I need to have, that demonstrates by my attachment that all other relationships seem like detachment? And that's kind of Jesus's point here. Now, don't throw the word hate out the window, because it's a very, very valid word. He uses it purposely. And there is a severity by which Jesus wants to use it and wants us to grab hold of this idea. And look, it's simply this. I have to be more profoundly attached to Jesus, not just casually attached to him. And my attachment to Jesus has to be so deep and so strong and so firm and so intense and so intentional that every other relationship appears to be detachment. You know, this is really the goal of parenting, isn't it? We're talking about our deepest, strongest loyalties. There's not many things that can trump that card of parenting. And in the Bible, the goal of parenting is full, complete commitment to the Lord. That's the goal. It's not good grades. It's not high academic achievement. It's not musical or artistic achievement. It's not sporting achievement. It's not having a great family that you can parade when people come over. It's not having a great family that you dare to take out in public without them embarrassing you. That's not the goal of good parenting. The goal of good parenting and the goal of parenting in completion is full, complete, and commitment to the Lord. We want our family to love, live, and obey Jesus. That's the goal, isn't it? And what is most important when it comes to bringing about a family is that full commitment to God, is that you yourself are fully committed to God. You can't expect your children to be fully committed to God if you're not fully committed to God. You can't expect your children to have an undivided heart if you don't have an undivided heart. And so it's the language of attachment and rejection, and we are to reject an idolatrous attachment to our families. You know, I spent some time this summer with a number of different families. And something I've heard over and over again for years and years and years is just consistent. It's a consistent theme when we're talking to families and parents and things like that. I met a family who were absolutely devastated that their 17-year-old daughter wanted nothing to do with church, wanted nothing to do with God. Really were beside them, didn't really know what to do. And it wasn't the only conversation I had this summer. They'd grown up in the church. This daughter had grown up in the church. Made countless professions every summer at camp for Jesus. And yet had now turned away. So a few questions in, I knew exactly what was going on. It's a familiar conversation. It was consistent with what was going on in many families. The problem was simply God wasn't God. Simply. No psychoanalytics needed. God wasn't God. What do I mean? Well, in this particular case, this girl had played in a county youth orchestra for 10 years, played the flute in orchestra every other Sunday. Family would take the daughter to the county orchestra, far away, some drive. And they said to me, "We don't know why she's lost her faith." And I said, "Can I be honest with you?" And most people, if they know me, they just say, "No, please don't be honest with me." But we didn't know each other, so they just said, "Yeah, be honest." So I was. And so I said, "Look, for 10 years, you've told her that divided loyalties are okay. And now she doesn't want to know God because for 10 years you showed her that she didn't need God. And God wasn't your God. She was your God. And for 10 years you showed her that. And now she's come of age, if you like, and now she has no reason to follow God because no one's really modeled that for her. And I know that's sad, but it's the truth. And it's consistent with so many families that we see. He hasn't been your life. He's been in your life. Absolutely. But he hasn't been your life. Everyone now and then, every now and then, I'll notice that, you know, someone from church is missing. And look, this is where the kind of some of the rubber hits the road for some of us. So I'm just going to speak honestly into that. Sometimes people will be missing from church. Maybe they'll be missing for a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks. And I'll send them a little text message or give them a call. Hey, just want to let you know that we're thinking about you. Is there anything we can do? Let us know. Hope you're doing okay. Message will come back. Oh, hey, yeah, sorry, we had family over. Pray to come to know the Lord. Do you get how ridiculous that statement is? Hey, we had family over. We decided not to come out to be with the people of God. Instead, we showed them that being with the people of God is actually really not that important to us. Oh, but by the way, pray that they come to know the Lord. They're not going to come to know the Lord by your testimony, because your testimony is divided. It's divided. Could it be that the reason your friends have no interest in the Lord, your children have no interest in the Lord, parents have no interest in the Lord, is that at any given opportunity, whatever that might be, you tell them by your actions that Jesus is prominent, but he's not preeminent. That you'd rather meet them than meet with the people of God. Doesn't that send a huge message to those around us about our loyalties? Don't we see this in the Old Testament? Don't we see it with Genesis chapter 22? When Abraham is there offering Isaac. Abraham, Isaac's only son, the son that he loved, the son of promise. How Isaac had been promised to Abraham for years and years and years. And then suddenly, all of a sudden, God shows up and goes, I'm going to give you a son. And you're going to love that son. And all the promises and all the privileges of Israel are going to come through this son. Could it be that Genesis 22 is all about God taking Abraham up to that Mount Moriah and saying to Abraham, show me where your loyalties lie? Could it be that Isaac, the son of promise, the one to all the promises of God were going to come to, who he had been waiting for so many years, could it be that this son started to mean a little too much to Abraham? I don't know. It seems to fit. And God asked Abraham to demonstrate where his worship was. And it wasn't that Isaac was evil. And let me just reinforce that. It's not that your children are evil. It really isn't. I know sometimes you can challenge that view. And it's not that your children are evil. It's instead that your children are good. So good, too good in your eyes. That's the issue. There was a disproportionate attachment, and God said to him, let it go. Let it go. Now, again, don't get me wrong. Humanly speaking, relationally, our families come first. Your job does not come first, your family comes first. And I'm not saying go home and ignore your children. What I am saying is love your children, but love Jesus more. Now, I said that hate implies rejection, but listen, hate also implies affirmation. Hate also implies affirmation. Because normally when you despise something, it's because you're affirming something better in your heart and mind, aren't you? I hate instant coffee. I would have thought there would have been a much greater amen. Obviously, my teaching is not bearing fruit, but still. Why do I hate instant coffee? Because real coffee is so much better. There's got to be a comparison. There's a comparison there being made. What that means is that the greatest gift, and listen, the greatest gift that you can give to your families is your complete, full commitment to Jesus Christ. You want to love your children? I mean, you really want to love your children? You want to love your wife and you want her to know that you love her? Or your husband, that you love him? The greatest gift that you can ever give them is your complete surrender to the Lordship of Jesus Christ. It's really a statement of how important they are. Because you are so important. You've got to know that I need God every second of my life. You're that important. Because you're so important, I can't allow apathy and divided loyalty to contaminate your development. I've got to love him more. And he's got to be everything to me. Listen, be careful in being seduced into disobeying the Lord by caring for your family. So dangerous. I've met too many people who use their family concerns as an excuse for not doing what God has called them to do. Don't use them as an excuse to disobey God. Don't let the devil cause you to worship at the shrine of your children. Don't walk out of here, though, hearing that I've said to neglect your children. Please hear me. Your children need to know that mom and dad will do what Jesus tells them to do no matter what. That he is preeminent in their lives. And this is what I think Jesus is powerfully underscoring here. How much do you love me? Will you do whatever I tell you to do? And look, verse 27, as he now kind of unpacks this, and we'll quickly go through this. As he unpacks it, he says, look, you may say, well, I don't have any family. Oh, yeah, but you do have a life. You want to argue over whether it's father or mother or wife or husband? You might have a rotten husband. By the way, you're still called to love him. You might have a rotten wife and you're still called to lay down your life daily for her. And you may have disobedient way with children. You're still called to love them and to go after them. You might have all the excuses in the world. Oh, yeah, but family. Listen, Jesus knows our own hearts, right? He knows our hearts. He knows we'll find excuses. He knows we'll try and find a loophole somewhere. He says, yeah, well, what about your own life? What about your own life? Even as far as that. Let me give you a quote. A.T. Robertson, in his book, Word Pictures in the New Testament, he says this, martyrdom should be the ever-present possibility to the Christian. Not to be courted, but not to be shunned. Love for Christ takes precedence even over the elemental instinct of self-preservation. But I want to save myself. Lay down your life. Take up your cross. This is exactly what he's going to say next. Surrendering your own plans, surrendering your own ambitions, having a willingness to serve him as he directs. Listen, he says, if anyone serves me, the creator of the universe, the sustainer of life, if he calls us to lay down our lives, would he not in that moment again give us the power to raise them up again? If the sovereign Lord, master and giver and sustainer of life with anything less than complete love, devotion and commitment to him, to the degree that every other relationship seems like hate in comparison, he says, cannot. Would you highlight that? Would you circle that word? Cannot be my disciple. Listen, that word cannot tells us exactly what we're missing out on. Doesn't it? cannot be my disciple. Martin Luther said this, that a religion that costs nothing and gives nothing and suffers nothing is worth nothing. A religion that costs nothing and gives nothing, suffers nothing, is worth nothing. If I'm not preeminent in your life, not just prominent, but preeminent in your life, you cannot be my disciple. 264 times the word disciple appears in the Gospels and in Acts. It is a huge topic. Jesus simply says, unless I am your all in all forever and ever, we're done. Simple. We read it in Luke chapter 9. It's worth kind of going over again. He's already talked a number of times in this gospel already about being a disciple. There in Luke 9, he's saying, as they were going along the road, someone said to him, I will follow you wherever you go. I'll be your disciple, Jesus. Aren't you glad to have me? And Jesus said to him, foxes have holes, birds of the air have nests. It's almost like Jesus is saying, really? I'll follow you wherever you go. Really? Can we say that? Can we say it with our wholehearted commitment and devotion to God? That if God today was going to call us to go, we would say, I'm ready to go. I'm going. I'm already on my way. Can we say that? And this is why Jesus, I think, replies just with just foxes have holes. Are you there? Are you in that place? Am I really preeminent in your life? Foxes have holes, birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. To another, he said, follow me. But he said, Lord, let me first go and bury my father. And Jesus said to him, leave the dead to bury their own dead. But as for you, go and proclaim the kingdom of God. And yet another said, I will follow you, Lord. But let me first say farewell to those who are in my home. And Jesus said to him, No one who puts his hand to the plow and looks back is fit for the kingdom of God. If you turn away, Jesus is saying, and decide to go and bury your father and not be my disciple, if you turn away and decide to go and say goodbye to those who are in your house, if you turn away and make verbal commitments without considering the cost, if you turn away because I say something that's hard for you and you don't like it, if you turn away, listen, this is what you're missing out on. You cannot be my disciple. The inexhaustible, bountiful joy of knowing the power of his presence in your life. That's what you'll miss out on. The undistracted privilege of experiencing his purpose and plan for your life, that is what you will miss out on. Don't accept the external process over an inward transformation that only comes through loving Christ supremely above all else. Look, let's finish. Verse 28. For which of you desiring to build a tower does not first sit down and count the cost, whether he is enough to complete it? Otherwise, when he has laid a foundation and he is not able to finish, all of who see him begin to mock him, saying, this man began to build and was not able to finish. Or what king, going out to encounter another king in war, will not sit down first and deliberate whether he is able with 10,000 to meet him who comes against him with 20,000? And if not, while the other is yet a great way off, he sends a delegation and asks for terms of peace. So, therefore, any one of you who does not denounce all that he has cannot be my disciple. So the question in verse 29, read it again. Otherwise, when he has laid a foundation, he is not able to finish. Verse 29 says, the question is, can you afford it? Isn't that a great question for our lives? Okay, so you want to be a disciple. You want to follow Jesus. Okay, let me ask you, can you afford to? Can you afford to? Then secondly, he asks there in verse 31, what king going out to encounter another king? The question in verse 31 is, yeah, verse 29 is, can you afford to? Verse 31 is, can you afford not to? Can you afford to? And then can you afford not to? This is the great deliberation. This is the great nerve that Jesus hits. I have no other choice. I can't be content with just saying that God is great. I have to be content with saying God is greatest. I can't just say that God is prominent. I have to say that God is preeminent. And my life has to reflect that. And that means I have to let go of every relationship, every stronghold that is over me, so that my detachment of those things looks like hate in comparison to my attachment to Christ. And he finishes the chapter by saying, salt is good. It is good. And what that means is, look, he's brought it up a number of times before. He's saying, look, you guys are not supposed to be like the disciples of Pharisees or disciples of earthly rabbis. You're going to live a different life. It's a much different life. You don't get to think, you don't get to hear these teachings go, well, I think actually what he means is this, as the other rabbis would encourage. You're going to be different. He says, salt is good. That's a good place to be. It's a good place to be attached to Jesus, to walk with him, to follow him, to follow hard after him. Salt is good. But here's the warning. If salt loses its flavor, if salt loses its taste, if salt loses its saltiness, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is of no use either for the soil or for the manure pile. It is thrown away. And he says, look, listen to this carefully. Evaluate this rightly. Think about this deeply. How fit are we for the kingdom? How fit are we to be used by God? How fit are we? How ready are we really to be followers of Christ? This isn't first-class Christian versus second-class Christian. So I want to be a disciple. I don't want to be a disciple, but I'm happy to just be a pew warmer. I'm sorry, it doesn't appear in the Bible. There's no distinction. You're either fit for the kingdom or you're not fit for the kingdom. Jesus is either preeminent or he's not preeminent. He's either the greatest or he's not the greatest. That's the choice. And so Jesus rightly says, look, if you lose that, if he's not, what good are you? What good are you here? Because if I say go, will you go? I don't know. Because you have all of these other attachments in your life. And the greatest promise, the great promise, is to know, through all of these falsehoods that Jesus has highlighted for us, that it's not a matter of our works. It's not a matter of our actions. Jesus wants our hearts. That's the dominion he's after. Yes, actions and service and things flow from that. Absolutely. They demonstrate these things. But where is our heart towards the Lord? Where is our heart towards the Lord? George MacDonald said this. He said, in whatever a man does without God, he must fail miserably. or succeed more miserably. Whatever a man does without God, he must fail miserably or succeed more miserably. The point, you have to have God. He has to be preeminent. We have to follow him and guard our hearts against complete and only externalism, because he wants that domain more than any other domain. Let's spend some time in prayer. It'd be good for us to evaluate our own hearts regarding this matter. It's so easy just to close our Bibles and, well, say amen and leave. Let's ask the Lord now to challenge us by his Spirit to see if any of these things are actually true with us.
You have been listening to a teaching ministry of Calvary Southampton. For more information, go to www.calvarysoughton.co.uk.